Can you tell me a little bit more specifically about what happened to your mother?
Well, she was extraordinarily beautiful woman from a middle class, lower middle class background, who was pursued by a number of very eligible young men and chose to marry my father in part, I think, I know, because it was a big step up on the social ladder. I mean, it went from where she was to money and to social prestige, and my grandfather was big shot in Lexington Republican Party, and he was a town father and a moneyed family. Mm-hmm. And she married into fancy cars and clothes and trips abroad and all of that. And she became imprisoned in that marriage, which ended them up in the house of his parents. And she became further imprisoned by those circumstances until the only way she had out was to kill herself. And she couldn't get herself and her children loose from that, and it brought her to her end. And it happened right in front of me, and it happened in my bed, and it was a brutal situation for everybody. And
was it a shooting or?
Yeah. And I closed down at that point. I forgot a whole lot. I forgot a whole lot of what had preceded that, and I forgot the several years surrounding that. And it's been my lifelong charge as a spirit, as a soul loose in the world, which is what the artist, that's the job of work the artist took up, was to see my soul through this life, all right? And it became the artist's job to cultivate and to deepen my soul, which involved going back to my childhood and remembering what it was that had happened to me and to my family and where I came from and the circumstances of my origin. And that's the fearlessness that I heard in literature when I encountered the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock has been the education that saw me through to that job.
Right.
It provided me with the ambition, the possibility to imagine that kind of honesty and fearlessness, and the tools with which maybe to achieve it if I was willing to learn how to use them. And that has been, I think, at the core of the experience that I've dealt with as an artist all these years. And if you put it in its simplest possible terms, it's a very simple vision of the fact that your life comes from death. Mm-hmm. That which gives you your life is death.
As well as the other way around.
I was obliged to forget that there was any love involved in that. Mm-hmm. And mind that engaged that job of work found that a good deal of the world outside my own private little story is equally interesting and fascinating. And so I have gotten off from I've gotten off from the core of that story. But even what I see in the on the ground glass of my cameras or in the language of a poem about nature is that very essential childhood experience of your life coming from death, and that she, the mother and the Mother Earth, who give you your life, takes it away, and that it all happens in your bed, and that it's your blood that you see. And
were you hurt in this experience?
Physically?
Yes.
No. No.
I was wondering how your sister has handled it all these years, or
she's just put it out of mind and declared it at an end, which is what most people would do. If once you get loose from the trauma of that, she picked up her life and went on and made a very coherent and respectable and friendly bargain with walking away from it all. And
but was she present when
she
it
was
occurred?
Yeah, she was there. And she was 5 years older than I was, and there's no question that it was devastating for all of us. There's no question it was devastating for my grandmother, my grandfather. He killed my grandfather. I mean, 6 months later, he was dead. And she made her peace with it in one way, which is the way most people would make it. And I've made it. And only recently made it in another way.
Through your work.
Yeah, and through not being able to walk away from it, not being able to get free of it. What Eliot taught me was that I was a soul on a journey. You know, I mean, that's one of the things you hear in the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock. One of the things that I heard is that there is such a thing as a soul taking a journey through life. Well, once I understood that I was a soul taking a journey through life, my journey led me back to those childhood experiences, to the origin. And, well, I, you know, it's if I had not if I were not in the process of finishing this book in which I deal explicitly with all of these matters, I would wonder whether or not I had any business at all putting on the record any of these matters. But I'm putting them on the record. And this is a, you know, this is a short and very oblique, very truncated description of the story that I'm trying to tell in Saying Grace.
Is the book that you're working on, Saying Grace, is this the work that has freed you the most?
Yeah. Yeah. So I did not understand that I was imprisoned until I got almost out. I mean, I don't think you can. I didn't understand that I had a inescapable lock on me in preoccupation. I knew that this was a recurrent thought, my mother and my childhood, but I didn't understand what it was that I didn't understand until I understood it. I didn't know what it was that I didn't know until I knew it. And yeah, it was in some respects it was simply a matter of having it confirmed by other people that what I had always supposed to be the case was indeed true, okay? Which is there was a scandal that preceded all of this. But we're talking about the level at which you know things and the responsibility with which you are able to engage what you know. I knew a lot of this all my life, but I wasn't able to be responsible to it. I did not have the ability to respond to it. for years and years. I had to get a whole lot of the rest of my life straight. I had to get strong. I had to find some fundamental things in my life that were very elusive before I had the strength to respond to what I knew. And then it came back around in at a different level in my understanding, and it said, if you do now, if you're ready to understand these things, if you're ready to be responsible, then you have to respond, all right? And the response meant...
Right. Would you say that creative people in any media, they're, in order to free themselves of any such experience, their ultimate therapy is in something they create?
I should think so.
As opposed to going to see a therapist. Not that would not be helpful, but that for creative people, do you think the need is there to find that truth through their media?
Yeah. I indeed do. And I think that what we're talking about is clarity of mind, and that what a therapist can help you do is to clarify your thoughts. But a poem or a piece of fiction or a film leaves off thoughts, okay? It deals much deeper into the experience. It deals in the imagery. It deals in the embodied fact, in the felt experience. And that if you can shape the felt experience, if you can take the image and shape it, if you can find the beauty in it, if you can create a beginning and a middle and an end that will release you from the experience, it seems to me that you're offered the chance there to deal with it at a much deeper level and be much clearer about it, much clearer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can think about these things and have thoughts that
right.
are nonetheless not as deep as the felt experience of
sure.
the image.
Right. I'm wondering about people who have no creative inclinations whatsoever. Do you think the facts would be sufficient?
It seems to me, in my experience, a lot of people don't need to go that deeply into their lives, and that they live the lives that they were sent here to live without any kind of introspection of that. So I see a lot of people like that, and they're perfectly happy and healthy and good citizens and good parents and good friends and all of that. There's no need for
right.
people to go unless you're called to. To join your soul on this journey, you can just let all that.
But the experience itself might have not been experienced on the level of introspection, which would you say that might be a difference? Therefore, it doesn't have to be worked through the same way.
I think some people go through their lives without having the full range of their affect, of their hearts or soul engaged. Mm-hmm. And I don't see anything wrong with that. I mean, it's nothing wrong with that. I mean, it's the way people's lives work out differently. But artists, I mean, you have people all the time say, is it really necessary to suffer to be an artist? And my God, I mean, if your head's going to be clear and your heart's open and you look around you, what do you see? I mean, it's suffering all over the place, right? I mean, everybody is in anguish. Everybody's dealing with a heartache. And if your heart's open, I mean, people think that open heart means joyousness or happiness. That seems to me foolish. I mean, open heart is a suffering soul.
Right.
I mean, joy and beauty
and
embrace of life is at the end of it if you keep it open, it seems to me. But boy, right up and through that is a great anguish and pain.
Yeah. No, I wasn't meaning to compare people in terms of quality and the level of feelings or anything like that. I was really wondering about if people have creative inclinations, do you think that whatever they have to work out in their lives, that they are compelled to work those things out creatively in order to ultimately be free of them?
I think so. If we understand by free of them, mean clear, you know, I mean, and released from them. And
Or at least to come to an understanding.
Come to an understanding and to find the beauty of it, right? Okay, I mean, poems are beautiful. And a good book is, a good piece of fiction is beautiful. And photographs are beautiful. And films are beautiful. And to arrive at the embodiment of the beauty of great suffering is a spiritual task of enormous demand. And
so the writer has to create something in order to be free of something that is not whole.
Yeah, I think what that people with creative instincts, said this earlier and come back maybe to a fuller understanding of it at this point. People with creative instincts are feeling the need to connect and cultivate parts of their mind and heart and soul that are not attended to otherwise, right? There's something missing in their lives. And if you experience that miss, if you experience that absence and that gnawing, then you want to make things, you want to create things, you want to find out what it is that you need to say. You want to make a piece of music that da da da, and that is an instinct to become whole, to go deeper into your mind.
That's an interesting observation, because I think most people look at creativity as an added gift, as something that other people who don't have it can't comprehend, that this is an addition instead of maybe a compensation for something that's missing, as you're suggesting. Or it could be both, just like your death from life and life from death.
Yeah, I think I see in my job at school a lot of people without a whole lot of talent in this context, you know, with not all that much verbal gift and with a halting ear and so forth, who are being called to the same job of work as those with great gifts and great talents, as far as I can see.
In writing?
Yeah, I mean they're both being asked to do the same thing spiritually, and they're asking themselves to do the same thing spiritually.
You're talking about internal being asked to, not an external. That their drive is the same.
Spiritually, it seems to me it's the same intersection. It's the same crossroads.
Right.
And that you can either go this way or that. You can engage your talent. You can engage that instinct to make something, to become a maker, or not. And if you do, what you're buying in for is a lifelong work. I mean, that's what most people, when they realize how difficult it is to make a poem or a story, say, I think I'll not do this, right? I don't want to serve a 10-year apprenticeship and then not be able to do it at the end of that. I want some guarantee that something's going to come. Yes, there is no such possibility in this business. When your need is deep enough, when you need to find out what it is that's gnawing at you, or what it is that you can't say any other way is deep enough, then you take on the life's work. Or, okay, I'm going to learn how to write a poem. I'm going to start reading. I'm going to start educating myself. I'm going to start listening. I'm going to start training my ear now. And then do that with filmmaking or with photography. You're talking about acquiring the skill to manipulate the tools to be able to bring about a connection with that which is gnawing at you.
Right.
And those keys don't come easily. They come a lot easier for some people. We say people who have got a lot of talent, I mean they can get those keys and jangle them a lot quicker than most of us.
Right.
But that's not always as it appears to be. A lot of people who have a lot of talent trade on it and end up glib and don't answer the spiritual calling of the work, which is to deepen their understanding.
Mm-hmm. How would you slot best-selling authors or authors who write a book with a mini-series in mind, other than business-wise at the moment? Artistically, how would you describe their calling to do what they do? Or people who write formulaic kinds of romantic.
I have no quarrel with any of those people or what they're doing. I mean, it's not anything that I have any particular use for.
No, I mean, do you believe that their instincts to create what they create are the same as the people who write less commercial fiction or poetry?
And that they just don't take it to its spiritual source?
Perhaps. That's what I'm asking. Somebody, whatever it is.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not that familiar with popular fiction, but I do understand the question you're asking, I think. And somebody told me recently, or I read recently, that Stephen King was often asked, why don't you write a serious book?
Right.
And he gets on it. He says, and these are serious books. This is it.
Right.
And he's got an enormous facility at making fiction. Mm-hmm. And yet, to some people, his work seems superficial and meretricious spiritually. And he's not putting his great gift in the service of a worthy calling.
I'm just wondering if you believe that some people have that choice. As somebody once said to me, why don't you write romances just to make a lot of money while you do what you want to do otherwise? And my response was, why do you think I have that choice? I can't imagine writing plays, but I can imagine every other genre.
Uh-huh.
Because I don't think spatially.
Uh-huh.
So I guess what I'm asking is really two different things here. One is, do you believe writers, for instance, have the choice of what type of writer they're going to be, not only in terms of genre, but also going back to the, if people are creating to fulfill a need, stab a wound, whatever, people who are turning out formula fiction for, say, Harlequin romance, because they know that it will be sold and they turn out three or four books a year.
Yeah.
Do you think that comes from the same need or not? Because it is creating something.
I see. the impulse in its origins might be the same as the impulse that created Anna Karenina, and so what happened in between? Did they have a choice in the matter?
Yeah. Is it the ability of the writer, in terms of their ability to write quality fiction or poetry, or is it something about the nature of the drive? Does it come
I don't
from
know.
The same source?
You know, I don't know. I would. What I was saying a minute ago is that all the writers that I see seem to me to be, most of them anyway, young writers or beginning writers seem to me to have similar impulses, which is to tell an untold story, to find out what it is that's gnawing at them, or to, as they would say, like express their feelings or whatever, and that at some point then they would have a choice whether or not they were going to leave this off at some superficial level, or they were going to take it as deeply as they could. Now, I suppose there's one way of looking at it. You stand out far enough away and says, no, nobody has any choice in these matters. It's all you just find out what it is that this life, that this time through, you were going to do, right? that you came up to a point where you thought there was an intersection, but actually the way your life had worked to that point, you were going to go left rather than right. I should think that at some point that writers who make money out of their books and have a choice whether or not to continue to write for money or not. And it's hard to imagine that they wouldn't have some free will at that juncture. But I don't know. I mean, I'm guessing about something I know very little bit about. I know that books that are written for money sound like they're written for money to me. And that, you know, books that are written in search of the truth sound like they're written in search, if the author's got the in any language.
Right. And maybe if an author is continually writing from a formula, that's part of the answer there. I mean, if sort of like painting by numbers as opposed to a real work of art, if you're filling in the blanks
with what somebody
else expects you to fill them in with as opposed to what comes from inside that needs to be filled or whatever.
It's an enormously powerful tool, fiction and poetry, and it can be used to different ends. And I don't see any need to make a hierarchy and say one's better than the other.
Right.
They serve different ends.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they're different.
Right, yeah.
And I don't have any need. I have profound need in my life for what Proof Rock sounded like. I didn't have any need at all for what Ogden Nash sounded like or Edgar Guest sounded like.
Right, yeah. I was just wondering about if you thought that even though their voices are different, their styles are different, that the needs of all writers are essentially the same in terms of why people who can create do.
That's a real pointed question. It puts a real spin on things, you know. I mean, if you say that Stephen King and T.S. Eliot were engaged in the same energy, which was to do as much as they could with language by way of representing what they understood, then yeah, it's probably true. I mean, T.S. Eliot understood things that Stephen King didn't, right?
Yeah.
But that they both were doing the same thing, which as much as they could do to get as deeply as they could into themselves.
Right. Is every writer writing about what is his or her greatest concern, no matter what that concern may be, and no matter if somebody else judges that concern to be great or small?
Trivial or
right.
worthless or
right.
sacred and
it's
profound.
It's still somebody else's concern.
Yeah. And I think that the critical question in that regard is what are you like on your deathbed? You know, I mean, people come to their deathbed with great regrets. That's all I saw when I was growing up, is life after life that was full of regret. At the same time, it was never admitted, very seldom admitted. And it was one of the key understandings that I had as a youngster, was that there was that much dissatisfaction in most of the people I was around, that much unhappiness. I hardly knew anybody who wouldn't live their life differently if they had a second choice.
Mm-hmm. And was this mostly because they were unable to admit the truth or even dare seek it in themselves?
Seems to me you get very little support for that, you know, very little support for that. You don't get any societal support for it. Society wants you to be a good citizen, and the truths of a lot of our lives do not bring us out in that role.
Mm-hmm. You don't shame yourself or your family.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You deal with your shame, and I was brought up, you deal with your shame by being silent about it, you know, you don't acknowledge it.
Suppress
and,
it.
Well, you just don't, by God, admit to it, and if necessary, you get somebody else to feel it, you know. I mean, you make somebody else ashamed or humiliate somebody else. There's not honesty in the world that I was brought up in is a fairly legalistic idea, you know. I mean, it's can you claim to be honest under courtroom investigation in which, you know, well, I went here and I went there. I did all the things I was supposed to do. Well, that's not what we're talking about.
Right.
And I don't think, I mean, there's a good deal of verbiage in the culture, and it's intense right now about self-realization and independence and but how much society, you find people who are in need of support for searching out the truths of their lives, they're finding it in little groups that get together for that purpose. They're not finding it in the main culture, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Or they're taking one thing and going all the way in the other direction, such as codependency being such a buzzword that it has its own section of books.
So yeah.
In Holly Cook,
yeah.
There's a codependency section.
Yeah. Which I'm sure has been profoundly liberating for a lot of people. I mean, that whole idea was freeing to a lot of people and continues to be freeing for a lot of people. But the minute it gets formulated, and
which
the minute
it
gets to be a buzzword, and the minute it gets to be a title in the bookstore, you know, look out.
It's now anything one does for someone else is liable to be labeled codependent behavior. So it seems the pendulum swings one way or the other, and seems like the publicizing of emotions so much lately has cheapened them in a way that fiction and poetry protects them by revealing the truth instead of just the facts. Anyway, I did want to ask you which of the several literary prizes that you've won has meant the most to you and why?
That's an interesting question I've never encountered before. I suppose the NEA, because it gave me a year off, you know, a year off to work.
And what did you work on?
Well, the Stanford Stegner Fellowship in Fiction did that, and that came at a time in my life when I needed confirmation as a writer. So I would guess that was probably the most important one. I needed to be authorized as an aspiring writer by an institution capable of such a gesture, and I was. So that was important, and the NEA. I did not, by that time, need that kind of confirmation, but I certainly had the same need for the time. Mm-hmm. And you asked what I did on my NEA year. I wrote poems and started the book Stopping on the Edge to Wave, and the few of the poems that are in that book were as they were written during that year or two. But I concentrated on poetry writing. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I was in New York, and at the same time, every night when I got free of my work, I went to the screening rooms and looked at experimental film. I mean, every time I get within striking distance of experimental film, which you have to be in New York or Chicago or San Francisco or someplace, metropolitan area to have access. I always spend as much time there as, I'm there when there's something being shown.
Hasn't one of your films won an award?
Yeah, there was the first film that the only film that I have finished and released won a honorable mention in the San Francisco Art Institute Film Festival a couple of years ago.
And what is the film about?
Well, it's a silent, 25-minute silent nature film that does tell a story about, the story is a cat kills a chipmunk, and the film follows the decaying carcass of the chipmunk. But that story is told in a way quite unlike anything you would imagine from that description, and it's very lyrical and dreamlike, and it's much closer to painting, say, than it is to narrative filmmaking, and people have asked me, why don't you put a soundtrack to your films? And the answer is, it's like asking a mime to talk. It's a silent film that works with a series of images that are dealt with in the way that a painter would deal with them, in the way that a lyric poet would deal with them,
right.
Not in a linear narrative way. But are like a jazz, an improvisational jazz musician would deal with a theme. And it's about the beauty of the natural world and of the process of decay, but it's
once
scary.
Again bringing life out of death.
Yeah, it's scary. I mean, it's a film that I think has moments of real terror in it.
I wondered, what do you think the most important thing is to know about you as a writer and as a person? And would that be one thing or two different things?
That would be one thing, but I wouldn't want to say what it was. I mean, I'm confident that it's one thing, but I wouldn't want to say, I wouldn't want to name it. I suppose that it involves my devotion to tracking this story, that I've been a devoted artist, and I think probably that as a person, I've been devoted to this job, and I mean, there are plenty of people whom I've betrayed who would say and devotion wasn't among my my character traits, but that's a real bear, Linda, that question.
This one is even more open-ended. Is there anything else that explains Jim Hall? 25 words or less.
Nothing explains.
Oh, I guess you would have to say that I had a hard childhood. And I came out of great pain and suffering that was not understood by anybody.
If you had an infinite amount of time and energy, what sort of writing project would you most like to tackle?
just continue the work that I got on the desk right now. You know, if I get done with this book, which I'm able and expect to do soon now, I got this novel that I was talking about earlier that I will go straight back to, and then there's another novel, and I'm sure that at some point poems will click back in, and that I will have to work in lyric poetry again. But right now, my writing is in prose, and it's a meditative, lyrical kind of prose in this book. But right on the other side of that is a fairly traditional, conventional novel.
Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you think would be important to mention?
I don't think so. I would say again that a great deal of my work in the last 10 years is a direct result of having met Marianne Taylor and gotten the help from her that I've gotten, and the love that I've gotten, and the support for doing what I have been talking about doing. And that wasn't, I knew Marianne for a long time before I wanted to marry her. So it wasn't necessarily the case at any point in there that I was going to see what it was that this meant to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. This concludes the interview with Jim Baker Hall on July 11th, 1991.